Welcome to Blondie and the Brit, Writing, Publishing, and Beyond. You can find our show notes and more information about our podcast at blondieandbrit.com. That's BLONDIEANDBRIT.com. Welcome to Blondie and the Brit podcast. I am Blondie, KJ Waters.
And I'm Suzanne Cowman, I'm the Brit.
And together we're Blondie and the Brit.
Yay!
Woohoo! I am the author of Stealing Time.
And I'm the author of The Rejected Writer's Book Club. Welcome to Blondie and the Brit. This week, we're excited to interview Thelma Adams. She is the author of the book The Last Woman Standing and also Playdate, which was an Oprah Beach read. She has written for the New York Times Magazine, O Magazine, the Huffington Post, The Observer, to name just a few. She has also appeared on CNN, The Today Show, CBS's The Early Show, Fox News Channel, Access Hollywood, Entertainment Tonight, Bravo, and VH1. She has done a lot. She has interviewed people like Julian Moore and Diane Keaton, The New Observer, twice chaired the New York Film Critics Circle, covered film festivals from Berlin to Marrakesh. Wow. Welcome. Welcome, Thelma, to the show.
So impressed by myself.
What we don't realize is I actually took a huge bio and cut it in half, and I was like, I wanted to leave everything in. Yeah. It was like, I just wanted to talk to this girl all day. She just has done everything. It's amazing.
I've worked for a long time, I've got to say, and all this time I've been writing novels. I've been writing novels probably, I wrote my first poem when I was 15. I just, you know, it's that thing, it's that kind of Phoebe Snow thing. Oh, no one understands me, I'm going to go and write poems in my room.
Aww.
Right. Well, obviously it paid off, because obviously you've done a lot with that side of your life. So you've had a really impressive and varied career. Tell us a little bit about your journey and some of the highlights of working in so many different arenas.
I think I was really lucky, because I came in at kind of the twilight of newspapers and worked at the New York Post when it was still had that kind of My Girl Friday feel to it, when it was, you know, a real newspaper down on South Street in New York City, and we were turning things around really quickly, and there were still printing presses in the building. And that's,
oh my gosh,
you know, that's kind of a really funny, exciting thing.
Yeah.
Wow, I love that you're part of that part of history too. I mean, I don't even know how they do it now. I bet there's no printing presses. I bet it's completely different how they do all that now.
Yeah, now it's completely different. But one thing that's true about the internet is that the internet really is very much like working at a daily newspaper, that old style of having to turn things out quickly.
Wow. So you started at the New York Post, did you say? Was that what you said? New York.
Yeah, I started at the New York Post and then worked there for 6 years. Then I went to Us Weekly right when it went weekly, which was an exciting moment, and was the film critic there as celebrity culture just exploded.
Wow.
And then I crossed the bridge to Yahoo Movies and went fully online. And all that time I was writing novels.
Wow.
Some that have been published, some not.
Wow. So tell us about some of the novels that you worked on during that time.
I wrote Playdate during that time. I wrote The Last Woman Standing, which is a historical novel about the Jewish wife of Wyatt Earp. And I wrote a big chunk of that when my children were little, and it was a huge research project. And I got to the point where I had to put it on pause because I had kids.
Right.
And a full-time job.
Yeah. I love the fact you were in so many. I mean, you're obviously working in film as well. Were you just reporting, a critic for film, or did you actually write screenplays or anything?
I haven't
like
written screenplays. I've produced, and I've helped people who have had fantastic screenplays, you know, make connections and kind of stood on the edge of producing. I realized that I have the personality of a writer. I'm not a tough negotiator, and I don't have a thick skin. And if you're going to succeed in movies, you have to have those things.
Right, that's so true.
See, as a writer, you have to have a pretty thin skin. You have, in some ways, you have to be porous. You have to be, let your emotions hang out. The two things don't really go together.
Interesting. I never thought about it like that. Quite true. So you started with the New York Post. You went out, you were writing novels when your children were small. How did that lead on to your U.S. magazine? And then where did you go from there?
During that time, I wrote Playdate. It was about a stay-at-home dad, and it kind of had this idea at the beginning that it would be a screenplay. It was about kind of Shampoo meets Mr. Mom, stay-at-home dad dealing with parenthood. But it was a way for me to write about mothering and mothering issues by putting it on a male character.
Right. Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about Playdate, because that became an Oprah Beach read. How did that come about? Did they approach you? Did you approach
them? It got very well reviewed, and I had done an essay already for O, which does fantastic essays. And I had moved from New York City to the country upstate, and I wrote an essay about that, about kind of realizing, having that like an epiphany moment of being in New York City and there was a big blackout and realizing that it was time to move, and then moving to the country and there were blackouts, and there still are blackouts in the country. I don't know if you've ever lived in the country.
Electric, yeah,
that's not
I live in the country.
Suzanne knows.
Read that thing where suddenly, yeah, you know, nothing works.
Right. Just windstorms. You know, the windstorm takes out our power, and then we can be down for 3 days. You know, so we have to have, you know, supplies, you know, every winter, because it's just living in the country, as you say.
Exactly. And the thing is, it's kind of romantic and kind of fun for the first, you know, 6 to 8 hours. You're like, if it's during the day, you can still read, you know. After a point, you're like, you know, I really want electricity.
My experience is that I've been through a lot of hurricanes, so the power's out. There's also, you know, the water main is broken, and so there's no water. You know, there's all kinds of other problems similar, but it's a big natural disaster on top of no power.
Well, you know, I haven't actually read the article, but I've read some of your others, and you are an exquisite writer. I was just talking to KJ about, I read your interview for The Observer, I believe, with Jude Law.
With Jude Law, that was a recent one, and he was lovely.
Yeah, but your writing was lovely. I mean, what I loved about it, and I was telling KJ, is you really draw people in. I felt like I was sat there with you. And I think that's a real skill, to be able to, you're a real observer, you're observing certain things that were going, even the little spit of skin as he, you know, I think that's a real skill. So when you approach an interview like that, how do you prepare for that? Because are you just very observant and you sort of taking all that in as you go? I mean, because you're asking questions as well. So tell us about
that. You know
what's
funny? One of the things that you said first, and I'm going to come back to this question, but I watch a lot of movies and I see where they waste space. And so when I do an interview and when I write an interview, I don't waste any space. So that's one of the things is that you notice in my writing is that it's, I guess you would say it's muscular, and that there's not a lot of spare look at me kind of thing. What I almost feel like with someone like Jude Law, where, I mean, how many times have we fallen in love with him in movies? Just
right.
Like,
and I then, just he's gorgeous.
Pardon me?
He's just gorgeous.
He's seriously gorgeous. And then there's all the kind of tabloid stuff that you know about him. And I feel it's really important to go and sit, like you sit in a room and try to bring your authentic best and hope that he is game enough that he will try to be authentic with you.
Wow.
And in this case, he's, and I've noticed this with other actors too, like Robert De Niro that I've talked to. When they have children, I have a son who's 20. Jude Law has a son 19 or 20. You can really connect on parenting issues. If you're willing to talk about your own experience, they will too.
And do you find that people like this who have been interviewed all the time are more held back? You have to find different ways to sort of get to the real core of who they are because of that?
Well, you know what? It's always tricky. It really is. You never know. You can be told that someone is the best and easiest interview, and they're always on their game. Like, I interviewed Vera Farmiga from Bates Hotel and the Conjuring movies, and I adore her. I've met her other times. But the day I interviewed her, she was like 12 months pregnant.
12
months? She was like, you know.
Ouch. You know what?
I don't know if you have kids. Yeah. I have two. There's that moment when you're like 8 months pregnant where suddenly, you know, the world, just isn't there anymore.
Right.
You're kind of like, you have so much energy and then it stops. So I interviewed her then and she just couldn't bring her game. She was she wasn't there. So everybody, it's like the day that you interview them, the project you're interviewing them about, the questions you ask. There's so many uncertainties that I find that I do as many interviews as I do. It's not like I do get nervous before them. I don't seem nervous. My friends think, oh, you're so cool, not like hip, but like you're so cool before this thing, or like I'm at a party and I'm talking to Winona Ryder, and I want to say to my friends, it's an act. It's like I'm an actor and I'm acting as a villain.
All right, wow.
That's cool.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. But Carrie, that's...
And it's funny because I was talking to my editor, I'm starting to work on my next book, which is also historical fiction, and she said, it's interesting, it's almost like you're an actor with your characters, like you jump into their skins and look out, which is something that I hadn't really thought about. But I think with Josephine Marcus, that's really true. Like I really tried to spend the whole book trying to imagine what it was like being in Tombstone, Arizona in the early 1880s, and really, but knowing that, like the two of you and like me, she was a woman in full. She was, just because she was in the past didn't mean that she didn't have the same range of feelings that we have.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about The Last Woman Standing. This is your new book, and you just got, it was literally like July 1st or something, I think it was published.
It came out July 1st, and it's... Right. It's doing huge. It's really connected with a lot of people. And the numbers are really good. I'm very excited. I've gotten a lot of good reviews. And the thing with that was just as a, it started in a sense, it started me being a critic and like, I never really liked Westerns, you know, or I never really liked war movies too, because there aren't female characters that I connect to in most.
Right.
Of them. There's exceptions. The Coen brothers, True Grit. Like, you know, I love, and I can love a John Wayne movie, but I'm not really there because there's no one on the screen that I relate to, that I connect to. And then when I found out this story about Josephine Marcus, that she'd run away from home, that she was from, that she was Jewish like I am, that she was from Eastern European immigrants, she left San Francisco, she went to Tombstone to have this big adventure. And I was like, what was that situation like? We've seen the gunpowder at OK Corral in movies. We've read about it in books. We have this idea of Wyatt Earp and his big mustache and his manly manness. I just was curious, what was it like to be a young woman in that situation? That was the kernel of the book.
Yeah, it's such an iconic time period, and to take it from a different angle of the female version. I know what you mean about the Westerns, too, because you put your finger on it, but there is the female element of that. So many other Westerns and other things don't have that.
There are Barbara Stanwyck Westerns, and there are some iconic Westerns that have strong women. But most of them, like if you think of Unforgiven, you know, where there's a lot of women in the cast, but they don't really have their own lives, yeah. They're prostitutes, period. Even up to last year, Hateful Eight, the Tarantino movie, where it was seven men, and then it was Jennifer Jason Leigh as the most hateful kind of...
Yeah.
I mean, they spend the whole movie just throwing stuff at her. It's so abusive. And I just really felt like, I know that there, you know, in any period of history, there are women and interesting women, and all these, there are so many stories to be told. It's kind of exciting to me.
Well, I like I like how you turned it on its head, though. Like you saw the gap, you created something, even in a time period that you weren't that interested into. I think that was very brave of you, and I bet it was a lot of fun to get into the heads and to kind of do all that research so you feel like you're there. It's
right. I liked it. And there's a lot of leaps of faith that you have to make, because as a historian, and one of the reasons it's all about guns and gun battles and wars and who was president is because that's what's in the newspaper. That's what's in the record. So you have to kind of look beneath it and look at people's journals and try to find ways to understand the time period that aren't that isn't on the front page. And that's why it has to be fiction, because there's just the unknowable.
I think it's amazing. Just an amazing. How did the story come to you? Did you hear about it or did you read something? Or how did that, you know, because you've been at work on this for a long time. So
I've been at work on it for a long time. I wrote the final draft in less than a year, but I saw that Wyatt Earp was buried in a Jewish cemetery in Colma, California. And I was like, where did that come from? You know, what, why? He wasn't Jewish. And then I kind of started pulling the strings and found out he was with someone for, you know, that he was with Josephine Marcus for 47 years, that she had written a memoir, and I went and read the memoir, and then I read an earlier version of the memoir that was less edited, but still edited. And it's funny because we have come to know this idea of memoir as huge confessional, you know, Augustine Burroughs or Catherine Harrison or Wilde. And her memoirs were not that confessional. They had been then edited by her nieces and relatives and other people afterwards. And so I really wanted to like read between the lines, capture this brave woman. But she's not just brave. None of us, you know, are just brave. Like, she went and kind of made this foolish leap. And like all of us who take risks, she got herself in a big pile of mud. She got herself into a lot of trouble and had to get herself out.
Wow. So exciting. It's actually on my booklet. As soon as I was waiting for this to come out because I'd seen this a while ago, and I'm like, oh, I totally have to read that story. It's still in my pile. I've been so busy, but I really want to get to it.
I have a huge – I did a piece for a Tampa paper, and they asked me what's on my, you know, on my side table. And I have to say, my side table next to my bed, everything is just like sliding because I have just so many books that I'm reviewing, books of that friends have written that I want to read. And I'm also just crazy right now about Elena Ferrante and the Neapolitan Quartet that starts with My Brilliant Friend. So I'm a big reader. And one thing about how I just have to read the books I want to read.
Yeah.
I'm not very good at reading, like, shoulds.
No, I know what you mean.
Yeah, that's hard. You're right.
Especially when you don't have much time because it's like this precious moment of yours. You know, you should be able to enjoy every second of it.
I love the fact that we're starting to see more women's stories out in film. And do you think, I mean, this seems like a perfect vehicle for film. Have you even considered that?
Oh, of course. Yeah, it's optioned. I hope to see it. My dream is to see it as something like Peaky Blinders, which is that Cillian Murphy show an 8 or 10 episode.
Miniseries?
Series. Yeah. And then maybe there would be more. I mean, Lord knows they were together for 47 years and there are many, many, many more stories. This is just their first 18 months together.
Oh,
but it's very cinematic. And this is the moment where there's a lot of interest in women's stories. And I'm writing about that a lot in my journalism about, maybe I'm contrarian. I just kind of think making an all-woman Ghostbusters or an all-woman Ocean's 8, we have so many better stories. We don't have to remake men's stories with women in them.
Right.
There's so many great women's stories that occasionally, you know, that do make it into movies, like The Help would be an example, or even Pitch Perfect in that series, or The Hunger Games, which is really female-driven. There's so many great female stories. I don't think we need to reboot male stories with chicks.
Oh, I totally agree with you. Same with me. I am a screenwriter as well, and there are so many incredible stories that I want to write, but it's like finding a vehicle for them is the problem. So in some ways, Hollywood needs to change. I mean, it is changing. I'm hoping over the next 10 to 15 years, we'll see a lot more women's stories, and part of the reason they won't make them is because they don't think that there's an audience for them, which is crazy, you know? So let's hope that really does start to change within the industry to allow more of these stories to come through.
Right. I think you're completely right. There is an audience. There's an audience, and it's also profitable.
Right.
It's like Pitch Perfect, The Help, The Hunger Games, Twilight, 50 Shades even. They've all been profitable. They tend not to cost as much money to make, so the return is higher. So it's really about getting the people that greenlight movies and greenlight TV to get rid of their bias and open up to women's stories.
I totally agree with you. That's been my bag for a long time. So,
and that's why Philippa Gregory is doing so well.
I love her.
Even Wolf Hall, which was, had written by a woman with a male character that was the main character, but the re-envisioning of who Anne Boleyn was.
I love that. I saw that. That was incredible.
Incredible. So I think that there are tons of stories and adventures. And I think now also there's so many women writing. The challenges, and as you both know, the challenge is always monetizing it.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, one of my last screenplays was a thriller with a woman lead, and I went to, and it was a woman in a burqa, it was a woman set in the Middle East. And
right.
I remember I went to a producer and I went to a couple of producers and they always said the same thing. This is a great story. Can we make this woman a man? And I would always say, well, you could, but he's going to look really silly in the burqa. I'm just telling you that.
Yeah.
It changes a few things.
You take away the whole story when you take away this character. It's like, I don't get why you don't see that. But they were just nervous. They're nervous to produce stuff that isn't a formula of what they know has been successful in the past.
I think that they're nervous, they're afraid, and they don't know. I mean, there are now more movies that are coming out slowly with female directors, not that many, but female directors, female writers. And then when it comes to the moment of distribution, there's uncertainty about how to distribute it.
I think Hollywood's changing. I keep hoping that is. And as you say, so many more females within the industry, I'm hoping that there'll be a big turnaround in the next 10, 20 years.
Yeah,
I think that people are much more activist. I just think it's a moment where people are much more activist. The interesting thing is whether everybody will help each other along, or women are being activists just so that they get the next opportunity. Like we all have to go in through the door together.
Right. That's really great advice. Yeah. I love that.
That's good. That's good. Now, can we switch gears a little bit and find out, love to get your advice on how someone who's interested in getting into the bigger media, the newspapers, the magazines, that kind of thing. Do you have advice for someone to kind of, who's looking to break into that kind of writing?
It depends on how old they are. In a sense, what I always say is start in college when you don't have to support yourself and really embed yourself in college newspapers, college online, things like that, so that you have clips from the very beginning.
That's
one idea. But for people who aren't in university, who aren't in college, I think start where you read. If there's an online site that you read all the time, then try to write for them and pitch them. The other thing you can do is start your own website. And that's like, it costs no money and you get a WordPress or whatever you do, and you go on medium.com and you start your own website. And you just, one of the things about getting a writing voice is writing a lot.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the first thing. But it is, I would say, a difficult time. If what you're talking about is getting a full-time job with benefits, it's a tough time.
I'm sure that's true. And it's easier for, you get the Huffington Post, other places like that, that have writers that come to them, and it's not necessarily a paid position. The world is so different than just your structured 9-to-5 jobs around this kind of thing. So they can get it in different ways. So your advice is maybe to start a blog, to, work on getting your writing out there through your own methods, and then pitch the places that you're really familiar with.
Exactly. Mine is write. Just completely write. And, if you like, there's a market for personal essays, and I know someone, her name is Susan Shapiro, she's in New York, and she has, has these long lists of all these editors that take personal essays, and basically her advice is always start with the humiliation essay. It's very easy to get those published.
find your worst moment.
Six hundred to 1,000 words of your most humiliating thing.
Wow.
And that is something that often has a market.
That's interesting. Your first step is to bare your soul and show everyone how stupid
exactly.
you are.
Which I'm not so sure, at my point in my career, it's like, I don't even want to dredge through all those humiliating things.
We've healed from those.
But it is good advice.
Yeah. And if that's what sells, you kind of have to write to the market, especially if you're trying to break into that.
That's the other thing. You have to write to the market.
Yeah.
another good bit of advice is have a news hook. Even if you want to write about something completely different, but look for some news thing, news hook that will get it published, or write something for Father's Day or Veterans Day or, you know,
right,
National Nurses Day, something that where there's a hook.
Great advice, because that actually puts you above when someone's looking for exactly that for Easter or whatever, and you've done that piece. That would be great.
Right. That's really smart.
And then you just put, like, you send them an email now, which makes it so much easier. And in the subject line, you go, you know, you say that it's hooked to something specific, that time is of the essence, and then they'll read it quicker.
Ah, wow, that's good, great little insider tips. I love it. Now, you've also been involved in a lot of the bigger media to help promote your books, Oprah and these other magazines. What advice would you have for people that want to get their books out in those kind of venues?
I'm thinking in that case, that was actually, I knew a lot of people because I was in the media.
Right.
And that helped. There are things like, TLC, which is a book tour, like there are book tour marketing things that you can do where they get it to bloggers and you pay a modest amount. And I would really recommend that.
Well, I've not heard of that. What is it called?
I think it's TLC. It's a book tour site. And my publisher booked me on that. And there are any number of kind of book blogger things. And also, if you start blogging books, if you start writing about books then, or interviewing writers, you know, on your blog, if you have a blog, or if you're doing Medium, then you have some kind of reciprocal. Reciprocity is hugely important.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't hurt if you have your own Facebook page, if you have Twitter, and people will say, well, I don't have a following. And then what you do is you go, okay, well, who are the 10 authors or critics that I'm interested in, and you follow them and retweet them and see what they're interested in. And you don't just talk about your own writing, you talk about larger things that are happening.
Right. Now that's very good advice.
That's always good advice. I think whenever you're approaching anybody that you want to have a connection with, is you definitely talk about their work and what they're doing and how you can support that. And, you know, in whatever way, then that's how you open up a relationship always.
That's good advice. Now, when you're doing the blog tour, is this something that then you would write about your book and then they would ask you questions or something like interview style, or did they just talk about your book and put it out there?
Tended to be people reviewing it.
Right.
So that, like, for the month of July when it came out, you know, there were probably 20 different bloggers, and every day there would be it would appear on a different blog post. So that got me a number of reviews, and then those people often go on Goodreads and Amazon and review. So that's a really good thing, and it's not an expensive plan. And then you have, like, you know, in terms of marketing, if you have a book, Facebook ads actually are a pretty good thing to get the word out to people that you don't know.
Yeah, we've had success with those as well, Suzanne and I. Just last week, we were comparing notes. You know, we bought the same kind of ad. Our audiences are completely different. So, you know, you can't really compare apples to apples necessarily, but we do.
You know, people have become, I went to the Romance Writers of America conference. I guess I went, it was the middle of July, middle of June. And it's mostly women who write these books, like 95%. It's a huge industry, $1.3 billion industry. And I went to, seminars where there were women who were very sophisticated about how they use Facebook ads and tracking what's successful and doing, like, three similar ads with different images and which ones are more successful and doing other countries and all of this stuff. It's a time where there's never been more opportunity for an individual to take action.
It's true.
Whether it's in journalism or whether you're a novelist trying to market your own stuff.
I totally agree with you. The world is open to us right now.
Yes.
We're going to go to the lightning round, I think. Hey, KJ?
Yeah.
I wish I could talk to you all day. You have so much great information. Go, KJ, you go.
Okay, Thelma, are you ready for our lightning round?
I think I am. You know, someone just actually... five people were just hit by lightning in the Poughkeepsie where I live. So
I know.
I'm a little bit nervous about lightning rounds, but okay. I won't stand under any trees.
Okay, we'll be gentle. We'll aim it somewhere else. All right, what is your favorite band or artist?
I'm not very good at favorites.
Pick one that you like. We could broaden.
What are you listening to right now?
What am I listening to right now? I'm kind of oldie, you know. Like, you know, I'm sorry. I'm just gonna go full frontal on this.
Go.
I'm watching this week, Tom Jones.
Oh
yeah, you go, girl.
I mean, the man can move his pelvis.
He can.
But someone sent me a video of him with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Wow.
And that to me was like kind of funny bliss. So I'm going to go with that.
That works.
I think for his age, he is looking pretty good. I mean, he really is. He looks good.
He's got such charisma, too. I mean, it's not just the look. It's just his something about him. He's got this.
He has
so much charisma.
He does. It's
and he does. You know, it's funny. Like he can be singing the same song over and over again, and every time it's as if it's the first song, and he's singing it to someone specifically right there in the audience.
Yeah,
totally.
He's got it.
Wow.
All right, left coast or right coast?
I am so split but I am definitely right coast.
Yeah.
I was born in Los Angeles, raised in San Diego, went to Berkeley, but you know what? I am an East Coast girl.
Yay, that's cool.
Wow.
So am I. I grew up in Maryland, so I'm right over there. What's your favorite writing spot?
Oh, I totally am anal in that writer way. Like, I have a seat in the living room. Because my office was three season, and so it'd be like it got too cold, it got too warm. So I am in the living room on the left side of a green striped couch that's all cat scratched. And we have a big stone fireplace, and it's very cozy. And there are always cats running all around me.
Oh,
wow.
That paints a
See, who would know that? You know, you want these incredible articles, and you're there with your scratched sofa and your cats. I love it.
Lately, it's like everything is about the kitten.
Of course.
That's cool. All right, are you a pantser or a plotter? Do you just sit down and write the whole thing, or do you plot out the entire story?
Oh, I have become more and more and more a plotter.
Yeah, people who start pantsers become plotters.
Yes, that's funny. It does seem that way.
Yeah.
I just think, especially with historical novels, it's almost like the movie business where you have tent poles in the summer. I think, you know, tent pole movies like, Star Trek. But I think when you're writing historical novels, like I knew that my main character came to Tombstone, that the gunfight at the OK Corral happened at a certain time. Like, you have to, like, when did she leave Tombstone? You have to ask these questions and arrange them.
Yeah.
So with historical novels, you really have to plot. But sometimes people think that means you can't go off in a strange direction. And you really can, within the plot, let the characters speak to you, or as I say, sometimes the characters start having sex with each other and they do it how they want to do it.
That is so true.
In fact, in this book, that's the case. There was one thing where they just started having sex and they were like, I could not stop them. Do it however you want.
You just throw your hands up, whatever. That's so funny.
In fact, I'm a little surprised. Because I had some steamy stuff that I had to pull back on. And in some of the comments on Amazon is like, some of them say it's steamy and some of them say it's like borderline porn. But,
darling, I mean, this was his relationship, so, you know.
Right, exactly.
Well, I think you just sold like 20 more copies right there.
Sometimes, you know what? Sometimes you can take a one-star review and put it on a Facebook ad because the one-star reviews are much more provocative.
Yes. Yeah, I had...
Like, there's bad language and sex. I'm buying it.
Now, I had a guy call my story salacious, and I'm like, ooh, I like that word. I'm going to have to start using that. And he wasn't saying it in a good way. He didn't, you know, he was whatever, uptight
but
about
it. But you like the word. You're like, I didn't think you used that word. That's a great word to describe me.
My book is salacious.
Which is fun to say as well.
Yes.
Okay, if you could be transported back in time, where would you go?
You know, if I could be transported back in time, I think Jane Austen's England would be good if I had money. I think anything transported back in time if I had money.
Yeah.
except for that. You don't want to be, you know, an aristocrat about to lose your head.
Or just not talk about cake and then you might keep your head, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think she got a bad rap, but that's a whole other historical novel.
Yeah, you need to write that one.
I actually am one of the few people who adore the Sofia Coppola movie, Marie Antoinette.
I think I've seen that one yet.
It's super, super fun, and it's Kristen Dunst, who I think is, you know, don't hate her because she's beautiful. She's a lovely, lovely, lovely actress.
Oh, that sounds like fun. She's a good actress. She's funny, too.
She's very, yeah.
If you had a superpower, what would you want it to be?
Oh, I watched this thing, this funny show called Trailer Park Boys that's from Canada. And the funny superpower he has is that he can always talk the police out of arresting him. Which I think there's some strange superpowers you can have. You know, I think I have the paranoid person's problem. I want to know what people are thinking.
Ooh. That's good.
I would like to be able to read minds.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know if I would like it once I found out, but I think that's the power I'd like to have.
Well, and as a writer, that could be extremely useful, because think of all the character development you'd get. You know, you don't just have to look at them and watch them. You know.
Nobody'd want to hang out with you, though. They'd be like, I know.
They'd all be wearing tinfoil hats.
That's right. Oh, God. All right. Who or what inspires you?
I get super inspired by my friend Nicole Gwynn. I went and visited her last week, and she's a writer and a director, and she lives upstate on a big farm. She has a dog. Her kids are grown. And I just feel like she has wisdom. Like, I go see her. And she can laugh, and she can laugh at her own mistakes. But she always, to me, she gets to the heart of the matter. And I leave her house, and I'm just inspired to go back and write and not be pulled down by the bullshit.
Ah, that's great. Sounds like a great friend.
Everybody needs a friend like that. Right. You should make sure she listens to this so he knows.
Required listening.
Wow.
Which book do you wish you had written?
You know, I really wish I'd written these books I'm reading right now. My Brilliant Friend by Elena Ferrante is like just, I haven't read a book that turned me on so much in a really long time. And My Brilliant Friend, the core of the book, of all four books, is a friendship between two women. And it's a very thorny, complicated friendship that starts when they're little schoolgirls and goes all the way until they're in their 60s. And it's just fascinating to me, and the writing is very fresh and very emotional, and I I'm impressed every time I read it.
Wow. What was the name of the book?
It's called My Brilliant Friend.
My Brilliant
Friend.
It's
in translation, and it's by Elena Ferrante, Ferrante.
Cool, I always love good recommendations.
Oh my gosh. I've recommended it to people, and I'm really surprised when they come back and they go, that was the best book I've read ever. And I'm like, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, good. That'd be a good one to write.
I love it when you find that kind of a book.
I know.
All right, so what's your favorite writing author moment so far?
I would say it was the moment that I realized that I have this great team of editor, agent, freelance editors, that I have all this whole team that really believes in me as a writer and is really pushing me to do more and better work. Mm. I feel like finally I'm not just a writer on the outside as a novelist trying to get in. There's a moment where it just like we're this team and we're trying to make me the best writer I can be. Mm. And that, I think, is something it took me a long time to achieve.
Great. Yeah.
And that's, I was going to say, that is so wonderful. Are you talking about Lake Union, the team you were there?
Yeah, I'm talking about Lake Union, my editor, Danielle Marshall.
Yeah, she's fabulous. She was my editor, too.
Oh, she's fabulous.
Yeah, she is.
Couldn't be better. Super smart. And my agent, Victoria Sanders, her associate, Bernadette. Just a big team of women who want smart writing.
Yeah.
And push me to be my best.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah, mm-hmm. That is so. That's how I feel. I feel very nurtured, too, in that relationship. So I'm glad that you said that. That's wonderful.
Yeah, oh, right. It is Lake Union. I forgot that's how we
connected. we're both the same publishers. I love our Facebook group. It's really great for exactly that. I mean, literally, you're right. If something will come up and you're just not sure, you go to the group and you've all been through it. So.
Okay, yeah. One last question. One thing you wish you'd been told about being a writer.
Well, you know what? Everybody tells you there's no money, you can't do it. There isn't anything, you know. People have read your stories and say they suck. What's worse is they don't say that they suck. They just kind of look at you like, you know, they're a little embarrassed and they say something kind of nice. I mean, the whole thing is.
I hate when people say that was cute. I mean, it's bad because I don't know the word.
Can't fill in the right word.
You know, if they're stretching and they're saying, oh, I really like this, you know, this thing that happens in the third paragraph, you're like, huh? But it really, the thing is, it doesn't matter what people tell you. If you have that passion, you have to do it.
Yeah.
And I have that passion, you have that passion. Nothing, you know, my ideal day is being in the middle of a book and, you know, writing, being in the middle of the book, knowing where I'm going, spending those 2 to 4 hours where I'm really connected to it, and then having the rest of the day doing yoga, making dinner, blah, 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 whatever happens. Yeah. But having had that moment where you just feel connected to the work.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah, I love that.
Excellent. So I'm going to add a question to Lightning Round just because I have to know. I understand you interviewed Matthew McConaughey. Please tell me something about that interview.
He was super generous. I mean, we ended up talking a lot about his co-star at the time, Jared Leto, because of that crazy movie they were in. And I, you know, he was very smart at that moment. It was very early in the Oscar favorite yet. It was in Toronto, so he wasn't so big into himself. And he was really, I don't know what I said. I cussed about something, like I dropped something or cussed or said something that was like not, it was off color, and from that moment we were connected.
Oh, she swore, and that melted.
I lost my mask. He loved that.
Oh,
cool.
That's good. Should we try that on the program, Suzanne? Should we just like swear?
Yeah, we're cussing at people.
Swear like sailors at the beginning.
It doesn't work with everybody. It works with
him. Yeah. Oh, if I ever meet him.
Well, when we have him on the show, thank you for telling us that.
If I ever meet him, I'm going to.
Sometimes it's hard with people who you find that are so attractive. Like, you know, you're sitting in a room with Hugh Jackman, and he's so, or, oh, the guy, Chris Hemsworth, I did a live interview with him for a movie he was in. And, you know, he's Thor. He's so handsome. But he's, like, so handsome that he's almost too big for a room, you know? Like, you don't know what to say. When you're on stage and you have questions about the movie, you know what to say. But when you're just talking back and forth, and he's 6'4" or 10 or 8 or somewhere, and he's so big, and there's so much energy to him. He's like a big Labrador Retriever kind of thing. It's really hard to have a human scale conversation. McConaughey, not that way. McConaughey, very human scaled.
That's very interesting. Well, thank you for giving us that little tip.
That's Hugh Jackman. Yeah. Did you say Hugh Jackman? Yeah. Is your favorite, KJ?
Well, Hugh Jackman I interviewed, and Hugh Jackman is an amazing, as you've seen when he does the Tonys and whatever, he is an amazing performer, and in an interview, he will answer any question that you ask, and he's very relatable, but also he's so handsome that you're a little bit like,
a little bit lost. or let me just stare into your eyes. What did I just ask you?
Tom Hiddleston also, you go through this thing where you like drop your pen, you drop your microphone, you drop your purse and everything comes out. You're so daunted.
Yes.
Wow.
I can't even imagine.
That problem all the time. I'm so gorgeous.
Oh my god, you're so funny.
I want your job. Where do we get your job?
I know.
Just shout, Blondie and the Brit will interview any of those good-looking men.
Yes. Please let them know. We're available.
And I go home to my husband.
Yes.
And tell him to do the dishes, the usual.
That's hilarious. Well, if you ever get a chance to interview Gerard Butler, please invite me so I can stare while you guys talk.
I've met him before.
Get out!
Get out. I was at a party in Toronto, a big party that he was at, and I have to say, he was picking up girls that were just like local girls, and he left and he got in a car with at least 3 women.
Oh,
there might have been 4 or 5 or 6.
That's the typical tabloid story about him, and I didn't want to believe it.
They were just friends. They were going to go play cards. They needed a team.
Oh, that makes me kind of sick. Thank you, Thelma, for being with us today. It's been a great interview. It's been great chatting with you.
A complete and total pleasure. I want to hear more about your books and your writing and what you are up to next time.
All right.
We will. Thelma, this has been such a joy. What a joy to speak to you. Yeah. And all your information is incredible. I'm so glad we got to know you. Really am. It's been a wonderful interview.
It's been wonderful.
Please join us next week where we welcome Haley from Buffer. It is an app that helps you schedule your social media posts. You can find our show notes and more information about our podcast at blondieandbrit.com. That's BLONDIEANDBRIT.com.